Hello and welcome to episode 12 of the Diversified Integrated Sports Clinic podcast. My name is Dr. James Boyle. I am a chiropractor here at DISC and I'm joined today by Tamara Ghazi.
Hi guys, good to be back.
Tamara is the medical director here and another chiropractor also. And we're joined today by David Labouchere. How are you, David?
Thank you. I'm very well.
Excellent, excellent. There's a lot to talk about today. You've got a very interesting past. I'm looking forward to getting through it. An introduction. There were so many things. I did a bit of research on you and there were loads of stuff coming up on your Instagram page and website and everything. And I just wrote down a few things. I've just bullet pointed them. Athlete, coach, gym owner, motivational speaker, international leadership advisor, serial world championship Ironman, Lululemon advisor or ambassador for Dubai, a retired colonel in the British Army, you awarded the OBE, and last but not least, husband and father of two. Anything else I've missed?
I like the Lululemon advisor.
That's
good.
You like
how much spandex to put into your... I love that.
Yeah, I was going through that list going, okay, you're only about 10 years older than me. I really need to get on my bike.
Right?
My list is about two. Very good. So let's start at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about yourself in the early days. Where were you born? Where did you grow up?
Well, I was one of those children who got sent off
quite
early. I think I might have been a bit of a problem to my parents.
Right, okay.
So from the age of 8, I was in boarding schools.
Okay.
Particularly good ones.
Okay.
Which was lucky because otherwise I'd still be sweeping up in the street, I think.
Okay, okay.
So I was given a very expensive education, which has to have helped.
And you mentioned a few. Were you sent from one to the other for bad behavior?
No, I started in one at the age of 8 in Oxford, so now I claim to have been educated at Oxford.
Nice.
But of course, people assume that's university. In fact, it was prep school from the age of 8 through to the age of 13.
Okay.
And then I went on to a place called Marlborough College, mm-hmm. which is quite close by in Wiltshire, mm-hmm. another boarding school.
Yeah.
And when I left there, I basically played sport at school.
Mm-hmm.
And I left and tried a proper job. And after 6 months of properly sweeping up in a warehouse, I decided all my friends were drinking champagne and playing polo, and that looked like a better way to spend my life.
So sounds like a better choice.
So I joined the cavalry and went into the army.
And that was that. You were in the army for 32 years, is that right?
That's right.
That's right. And the Royal Hussars?
Yes, the Queen's Royal Hussars.
And your grandfather was in that as well, is that right?
You've done your homework, yes.
I've done a wee bit.
Well, he was Colonel Peter Labouchere.
Okay.
And he was a very good commander just after the First World War in Palestine amongst other places.
Okay.
And just after the Second World War, I should say. And I never knew him, but when I left school and decided on a job, it seemed sensible to go into the family regiment.
Okay, okay. And so you weren't sort of at a very young age and thinking, I'm going to join the military?
No. Okay. I was often asked, what are you going to do if you grow up?
Yeah.
Whereas everybody else was asked, when?
All right. okay.
And I didn't have many plans. Indeed, I left school and I was asked by my father, would you like to go to university?
Mm.
And as I was not very academic, I decided that that would probably be a waste of his money and my time.
Okay. With your long history in the army, do you think that those sort of, I think of self-discipline, determination, things like that. Do you think those traits were within you deep down somewhere, or do you think you got those from the army? Because certainly even after the army career, so much of your history has had that discipline to it.
The army in the 80s was a much more amateur affair than it is now.
Okay.
So when I joined in 81, 82, it was for all the wrong reasons.
Okay.
I was joining for a lifestyle. We were waiting for the Russians, mostly in Germany. I started in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians were vastly more effective than we were. And therefore, we knew that we had about 3 days to live when the balloon went up.
Wow.
So it wasn't actually the very well-regarded organization that it seems to be now.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, until about 1989, when the wall came down in Berlin, it was a vehicle for partying and smoking too much and mm-hmm. living well for many of us in the cavalry. There were very, very professional units, but we weren't one of those.
Okay. So keep going. Tell me more. What happened after that?
Well, two things happened. The wall came down, and the other earth-shattering moment was I met the girl that I wanted to marry. And
a German lady?
No. By chance, I'd been sent home for about 4 weeks, and I found an English girl.
Okay.
And she was fantastic and wonderful, and within a week, we decided to marry.
Wow.
And within 10 days, we knew what our children's names would be.
Okay.
And so in a very short time, we got married. That was 26 years ago, and she's here with me now, and there's been no break in that. It's worked. So it's, but her name is Caroline, and BC, before Caroline, life was very different to after we married.
What it is now.
So I started behaving a little bit better and not drinking quite as much and not smoking up to, well, certainly 3.5. I don't think I ever finished 4 packets of cigarettes in a day, but I got close.
Wow.
I wasn't a healthy person, but at the same time, we weren't a very healthy organization.
Okay.
But as the demands on the army increased, we became much more professional. Okay. We had to. It was that or die.
Yeah.
So we got much better. We did a lot more operational work around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I happened to be in the right place or the wrong place at the right time to get involved in every major conflict that the British Army has conducted since 1982, since the Falklands War.
Okay.
So I think, again, my lords and masters decided that I'd be better sent away, and they sent me on every operation they could.
Mm.
And on that experience, I was promoted. But it was a matter of being there, not because I did anything clever while I was there.
Okay.
But you came back and you'd been in the Balkans, or you'd been in East Timor, or you'd been in Sierra Leone, and therefore you must be better than the ones that hadn't been.
Okay.
Which is a very flawed logic, but it did fuel my slow rise through the ranks.
Sure. Well, if you managed to survive, then you must be doing something right.
I think I was surrounded by a lot of very nice people who helped me survive.
That. Okay. So out of all those 32 years in the British Army, what is the most sort of single, most memorable experience that you've had?
I think operational tours generally and leading soldiers is the most memorable thing. People talk about this generation being softer. You know, they're the PlayStation generation or they have Adidas shoes instead of good old leather boots.
Mm-hmm.
And people talk about the lost generations of the First World War and the Second World War as if they were special people.
Yeah.
And while they undoubtedly were special people, the young of today are just as special. And what one realized when in difficult situations is the pure bravery of the average youth, and they are 18-year-olds, and how very courageous they can be in really difficult situations. Down to people who were doing extraordinary things, having lost a leg, for instance, you know, and still saving the lives of their comrades, even though they were in a position where they were going to die very shortly.
I listened to a story that you were telling an audience of the medical private who was saving the life of a sniper.
A sniper had actually shot her commander, and the bullet had taken away the lower part of his face, none of which is essential for life.
Mm.
But his tongue had dropped back down into his windpipe, and his jaw had gone, and everything below his nose had been taken away because the bullet had struck his hand and his rifle.
Mm.
And when that happens, the rifle passed through his face as well.
Mm.
So he was in dire straits and not capable of functioning. He was just about breathing, and she climbed out of the back of the vehicle, knowing that the sniper was still operational.
Mm.
And she was hit 3 times while she tended to him, once through the boot and once in the across an item of her belt and once in the pack in which she had her medical supplies.
Mm-hmm.
And she was only 18 years old. She was 4 months into the job, but she knew what her job was, and she kept going, and she probably saved his life. And it was only when the rest of the crew dragged her back into safety and him that she realized, well, I think she realized what was going on, but it was at that point that she acknowledged that she had been hit 3 times, but no damage to her whatsoever. Amazing bravery.
Yeah, and do you think you can train that kind of, whatever word you put on that, what do you put on that?
I think it's bravery.
Bravery.
It's straight courage.
Mm.
Yes, you can, if you give people the right training and... I think courage is a bit like willpower.
Mm.
It is finite. the more often you're brave, the less likely you are to be brave next time. The more often you pass by the fridge that's full of Snickers, the less likely you are to abstain next time you pass by the fridge full of Snickers. It's exactly the same with courage. You can use it up, which is why I tell people don't buy the Snickers, don't put it in the fridge, because you're going to use it willpower every time you go past, and it's much better not to use your willpower on that.
Right.
So with courage, we try not to put people in situations where they're going to have to be incredibly brave too often.
Mm.
Because you might get to the point where they're not going to do it anymore.
Right, it runs out. You've spoken internationally. You're an advisor in that regard on motivation and leadership, and you've done that with prime ministers, I think.
I worked in London in Whitehall as a strategic planner.
Right.
I wasn't advising Tony Blair or Gordon Brown on what to eat.
Okay.
I was actually trying to inform them what might be the best course of action from a military point of view with regard to foreign policy.
Right, geopolitical risk.
Term.
Exactly.
Yeah. It sounds terribly highfalutin, but it's actually just normal people chatting around a table most of the time. And in my case, being ignored.
Okay.
Because it doesn't matter how important the information you are passing is.
Mm.
Sometimes you are a lower priority than, say, the next election.
Yeah. We're obviously in Dubai at the moment in the Middle East. Do you think there's a safe place in the world to live?
Well, I hate to sort of put pressure on Canada, but that's where I'm going. But not particularly because it's a safe place, although Caroline sometimes says to me, you know, nobody seems to hate Canadians.
Yeah, true.
And actually Canadians are very hard to hate.
Mm.
And therefore... Canada seems to be a pretty safe place from my point of view. They've got an interesting and dynamic young prime minister. They're going places. They've got space.
Mm.
And they're very nice people.
Yeah.
It's also freezing 8 months out of the year.
Yes, but you can dress for that.
You like to ride a bike and be in the sea most of the time,
dress
from what
for
I
that.
Know.
The swimming.
You're going to go swimming in minus 30.
There's ice, of course, but. But you can still
David will do it, huh?
Yeah.
You put on sort of skinny skis and go Nordic skiing, and you can stay fit.
That's fun. Yeah.
And also you can buy yourself a nice RV. I think they call them a large trailer in which you live like a lord.
Yeah.
And you load up your wife and your dogs, and you go racing in the south of the North American sort of continent.
That's great.
And I'm planning lots of road trips.
Nice.
And my wife, who runs very well, will race 1 week and I'll race the next week, and we'll alternate and we'll choose races all over the country and just drive around having fun.
Perfect. That sounds pretty good.
And then we'll go back when the sun comes out.
I like it. So at the risk of getting too serious, what do you think about North Korea at the moment and Trump and all that kind of stuff?
Now, you will find I am left field, a little bit different.
Yeah.
And my immediate reaction is any talk is better than no talk.
Mm.
Churchill said, jaw is better than war.
Yeah.
Now, I know that North Korea is a very strange place led by very strange people.
Mm.
But there can be nothing wrong with communication. And if Trump says he's going to talk to Kim Jong-un, then let him talk.
Yeah.
Because it's better than not talking.
Yeah.
And what is the alternative to talk?
Yeah.
It's pretty awful to comprehend.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of all the wars that we've taken part in since 1982, I don't think I could call any of them a success.
Yeah, true.
So this war thing, this send boots on the ground, doesn't seem to work. So let's try something else.
Yeah. When and why did you come to Dubai?
Well, I was promoted to brigadier, which is a terribly important position, I felt, because of course to me it was. I only knew senior people who were brigadiers. Mm. My wife pointed out that a colonel or a corporal, nobody knows the difference.
Right.
So she said, well, we got a choice of going off to this rather cold castle and being in command of a brigade down in Dover, which is not the best place in the world to be.
Yeah. With the greatest respect to Dover.
Or David, you've just picked up an invitation from the United Arab Emirates to come and be an advisor to the establishment in the UAE.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, okay, as long as I can be a brigadier. unfortunately, so I passed up the brigade. Yep. And we moved here because it was better paid. Mm-hmm. The sun shines. Mm-hmm. I could play sport.
Yep.
And I wouldn't be commuting on the Metropolitan line every day for the rest of my life.
Sounds like a plan.
Which was the alternative.
And what year was that in?
2010.
So
for 4 years, I worked for the UAE. Mm-hmm. And while it was an interesting job, it mm-hmm. wasn't that rewarding in terms of job satisfaction.
Okay.
In fact, I realized very soon after the contract ended in 2014 that I'd never been happier after it ended.
Okay.
And I was happy because I was, for the first time in my life, for the first time in 52 years, I wasn't institutionalized.
Okay. Freedom. Shackles were off, so to speak.
Well, I spent a lot of time in cafes pretending to look for a job.
Okay.
And in the meantime, I went to Kona instead and did lots of sport.
Right.
But I think Caroline really thought I was looking for a job, and I probably was going through the motions. But in fact, I don't think I really wanted to work for somebody else.
Okay. Okay.
So when I got interviews, etc., I'm not sure I was that plausible, that credible.
Right. So what? Let's talk about your triathlons. What initially inspired you to get into that? You started that in 2009, is that right?
Yes, in 2009.
What were you doing before that?
Well, I played a bit of rugby, mm-hmm. which I'd always played rugby, and I kept playing rugby as I got older. Mm. The joy of getting more senior is that they pick you because you're the colonel, you're the boss, so they'll give you a slot. I wasn't good enough to be in the team, but okay. I managed to lie to myself. But you also find that all your jokes are funny. But of course, you realize once you leave that sure. they weren't and you're not. And I wasn't that good a rugby player. I was probably a B-team player at best, but I played until I was 47. Mm. At that point, I was getting so sore on a Friday that it would take me until the next... On a Saturday, I mean, it would take me until the next Saturday to be recovered enough to play again. So yeah. There was no training going on. It was just sort of drag my tired body to another rugby match, love the match, and then suffer for a week afterwards.
Yeah.
So that went out. I had ridden a bike behind a friend of mine who was a triathlete and found that I could keep up with him. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about drafting. I didn't know I was taking a 40% advantage by being behind him. I just thought I was a good bicyclist.
Okay.
And so I bought a bicycle, and I couldn't swim. I was a breaststroker. I'd mm-hmm. always got through my British Army swimming test by breaststroking around the freezing lake.
Okay.
And pretending not to be cold when everybody else was pretending to be cold. And so I wasn't a swimmer, but I could ride a bike, mm-hmm. and I didn't have a proper bike. It had a basket on the front.
Right.
And
you bought that at a police auction or something years previous.
You're good at this. James, where do you get this information?
It's all online, buddy. I've been stalking you for days.
It cost me 25 Canadian dollars, that bike, but it did a lot of miles with me. Anyway, the answer was that I ended up getting a bike, and I went to the UK Half Ironman Championships in Wimbledon. Mm. And did okay there, and went straight on 3 months later to the full Ironman, which was in Bolton for the first time. And I did okay there. So that was me. Once you've got a little bit of success, you sort of get all sort of fired up and think it's easy. And then it took me another 3 years before I qualified again for the World Championships. So it wasn't. It was a pure case of who turns up to the race on the day.
Okay.
And luckily for me, none of the fast boys did.
Okay. Well, I mean, you were 19th in the world or something, the last
that
Kona.
That was 2013.
2013?
I wasn't 19th when I went again. In 2014, I was 24th. And then 2015, I went to Kona and I was about 40th. And I realized I was slipping fast.
But you're getting older in your age group, isn't that right? So
well,
it doesn't.
And this does make a difference at this age, because I'm now 54 and the age group is to 54. So all these 49-year-olds are coming into my age group, and there are many more of them now because this sport is growing so quickly around the world.
Yeah.
And they're all very good. Mm-hmm. In fact, of the top 10 in the world, I think 4 are in Dubai.
Wow.
So I'm up against it. I'm up against people like Sam Westhead and Finn Sueger. And Chris Knight. And
okay.
These guys are all coming into the age group at the lower end and are much better athletes than I was at that age because they're just better.
Yeah, okay.
And much better. And that's why I've slipped down the rankings. I'll continue to slip until the end of this year.
Okay.
And then I'll be the young boy. I'll be the youngster.
Then you'll
and
be...
It's the only sport in the world where you look forward to getting older.
You know? Okay.
Oh, I can't wait to be 55.
Right. And you've famously said you're going to be racing in 2047 or something.
Well, yes. and actually, I might have to extend that because, of course, all these people get fitter. And the oldest guy who's done Iron Man is a chap called Lou Hollander. Mm-hmm. And he's currently 85. He hasn't completed one at 85. So that's my aiming mark. Mm-hmm. But, of course, by the time I get to 2047, some bugger's going to have done it at about about 90.
Absolutely.
And so it might not be 2047. But whatever age it is, that's when I'm going to be competing. And once I've won the world championships, and obviously winning the world championship at that age just requires you to complete it because you're the oldest, and therefore there's nobody else in your age group.
Good odds.
So I've just got to keep going. And then I'm going to defend it thereafter for as long as possible. So I don't plan to stop when I've done it. I plan to keep it going because I truly believe that we are all going to live a lot longer than people assume. Now, you're a doctor and this is at the Diversified Integrated Sports Clinic. You guys know that people are going to live a lot longer because medical science is working very fast to make sure we do. Of course, that has huge implications for geopolitics and population expansion, especially in this region. Mm. But what it means for the rest of us is that we ought to be planning to be healthy for a lot longer, because if you're not planning to be healthy, you're going to have a pretty miserable life sitting in an adult nappy in the corner of some smelly old people's home in with grey skies outside, having a miserable life for a very long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I don't want to have a miserable life for a very long time. I want to have a happy, active life for a very long time. So I thought that doing Iron Man for as long as possible would be a good vehicle to make sure I stayed healthy.
Right, and that's the way you see it, really. I mean, obviously you enjoy doing it, but you see it as a vehicle. As opposed to,
I think it just satisfies all the healthy habits that one ought to have. I mean, it's not about, you don't have to have that sort of strength that a power lifter needs. Mm. It's functional strength. Mm-hmm. It develops your heart and lungs so much more than CrossFit would, for instance. Mm. So what you're doing here is just maximizing the body's output. Potentially, depending on your beliefs and Darwinism and everything else, potentially in a way that we were designed for, because we were, you know, we hunted by outlasting our prey. The gazelle goes faster than us, but once it's sprinted six or seven times, it's getting slower, and then it'll stop, and then you catch up with it. Mm. So I think this endurance sport is something that we are physiologically designed to do. I understand that we're the only beast in the world that can breathe, use our lungs at a different rate to the way we use our legs and arms. So we are not taking a pace and a breath at the same time, which means we can go a lot longer as we get fitter. I breathe out for about nine paces. I breathe in for nine paces when I'm running.
Okay. What about the emotional side, the mental side? I mean, I think coming from your background, you kind of have this mental strength, and I'm sure it comes a lot from who you are as a person, not just your work history and you know what you've experienced. But I know in endurance sport, it requires a lot of mental strength. And I mean, we were talking a little bit before the podcast about how many people I see on a regular basis who are in pain because they're very emotional, or they're emotionally in pain, or they're not in a good place. Has this helped you, or do you think it's your mental strength that's helped the sport? Is it, you know, the whole chicken and the egg thing? Or
I'm not sure. I divide this into four slots. I divide it into the physical side, which is all about sleep, good nutrition, and exercise, in that order. And then I think about emotion. And then I think about mental, different to emotion. And finally, I think about spiritual. And by spiritual, I don't mean any particular religion, but a sense of right and wrong. And I get my energy from mostly relationships. I'm a very externally motivated person. I was always a show-off. I always wanted to be the big I am. I wanted to be in the center. And actually, this sport has given, maybe it's because of that I do this sport, because there is a large community of people who support each other.
Yeah.
And that support, that sense of, you mentioned Kim Jong-un, it's relationships. If we can develop relationships, we are a lot stronger than those who don't have relationships. There's a wonderful study, it's I think it's Stanford, which has been going on since 1939, where they started with 19-year-olds, and it's the happiness study. Mm-hmm. And it's still running. They're on their fifth study director. And this study basically identified that happiness, and they took people of age 19 from the highest status and the lowest status. So we had all male, typical at the time. Mm-hmm. But they studied these people from 19 years old until they die. Now, there are very few left from 1939.
Mm.
We're talking about 96-year-olds now.
Yeah.
There are 60 left of the 700 that started.
Wow.
And they test them each year, physically, emotionally, mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And they question them about what makes them happy. And overall, it was not whether you went from the higher status being from an Ivy League family and you lost all your money. That didn't make you any less or more happy than the man who started from being a garbage collector and went on to be the CEO of a great company.
Okay.
Neither of those trajectories increased or decreased happiness. The only thing they found is relationships. It's all about relationships. And relationships, the happiest people were the ones who had the longest marriages, interestingly. But the ones that had bad marriages, then you had a big drop-off in happiness. And the ones that divorced and then married and found happiness through a better relationship, obviously, showed more happiness.
Mm.
But the end result was relationships. Relationships are happiness. And ever since I was sitting in the cafe pretending to find a really high-paying job and not managing to, I realized actually the happiness that I got was not from a decent wage, but from the reaction on somebody else's face when you make a difference to their status, position, fitness, health, particularly health. And the happiness people get from being given something.
Yeah.
And that sort of feeds straight back into my psyche in terms of my happiness. So everything I do, I sense, is probably for my own ego. But it makes me happy.
Yeah.
And a lot of that means giving. And I've realized that by giving, you get a lot back. And so this happiness survey really has colored my life. And it's all about relationships. And so when you say, what is it that drives you? Is it your mental state? I say, actually, it's friends, it's family, it's those that I care for and reciprocate by caring for what I'm managing to do. And I try to, if I'm in a bad place on an Ironman, and I don't find I go to these deep, dark places that people sometimes mention, but I do sometimes get pretty uncomfortable if you've got cramp or you're running out of food, or in my case, you went too fast on the bike and therefore you've got nothing left for the run and still you've got a marathon to run. And what I find there is that I think about those that are watching online. What my wife has been through in terms of putting up with my early mornings, my late nights, my grumpiness, my constant demands for food at strange times. And I think about all that as being now it's payback time. And those relationships are more than 25% of the energy that I get to train, to get up in the morning, to go swimming, etc. It's relationships that make us all happy.
And yes.
Some of us now focus on those relationships because they want to be happy all the time. And I want to be happy all the time.
Is it when someone comes to you for some coaching, do you lay that out at the outset? Or do you start to say, okay, let's run 100 meters and build up the physical first and then the mental? When does the mental sort of aspect of it come in?
I think there's absolutely no point in giving anybody physical advice if emotionally they're in a muddle. Now, there's another part. We mentioned emotions, and I've said that's 25%. I think the physical side is 25%. But I also think that a proper focus, a mental goal, is 25%. And what I think of there is you've got to have a target. Now, I've set mine out here by saying I'm going to be the oldest Iron Man in history.
Yeah.
That's a pretty stretched target. You know, that's out an awful long way. I've got some closer in ones.
Yeah.
And they drive me. I tell all my friends, so this goes to emotions too, but I tell people, this is what I'm aiming to be. And they look at me as if I'm mad. But in fact, by telling them, I've now created some external audits to make sure I stay on task.
I
can't just decide to change because I'd have to tell all these people that I've decided to change from this aim to that aim. So that mental focus becomes 25%. I know that I'm going to be on the podium next year at the World Championships in Kona.
And that's it.
The podium's five people. So luckily, because if it was three, I think I might miss that. But I'm that's my plan. Now, if I miss, well, I've shot for the stars and I've hit the moon mentally. I miss and I come 10th. Okay, so be it. But at least I've got a mental focus of what I want to achieve. So that mental focus is the next piece that I try to advise people to have. And the first thing I'll say to them is, what does the best James look like in 5 years' time?
Mm, okay.
And if they've got an idea of what that is, we're already well on the way to doing this right. So then the next piece and the final piece is doing it right.
Mm.
I really want to be remembered as a contributor, not as some sort of a vampire to everybody's lives. And on that basis, I imagine a box in the middle of the room. And I walk into the room and everybody is talking about the bloke in the box and it's me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dead. I've passed on. And I'm floating around the room listening to what my friends, my family, those that bothered to turn up. And I want it to be a reasonable crowd.
Okay.
And I want to hear them say, David was a good guy. David did it right. David didn't cheat. I don't want them to be saying, David was a good guy, but. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear those buts. So now I'm trying. I don't always do it. I don't get it right. I'm miles off perfect.
Mm.
But I try to live my life in a slightly excellent way. So I try to excel in everything I do.
Mm-hmm.
And in that probably means that if I can do that and I can continue to improve it, then there'll be less people standing around saying, but, when I've gone.
Yeah.
So I won't cheat. And if I'm all on my own and there's a chance to cut the corner on a race, I won't cut the corner. And if there was a chance to improve my performance through taking something,
mm-hmm.
I won't.
Okay.
And if there's a chance to help somebody else achieve their goal during a race, I will, because of that sort of right and wrong thing. Now, you know, I was never, not always like that.
Okay.
But now I think that's where my happiness comes from, where the extra energy comes from.
Do you think people set their goals too high or too low?
Always too low.
Always too low.
Always too low. Because they're afraid of not achieving them. So I always set mine consistently too high.
Okay.
And then when I miss, as long as I got as close as I could, then I don't feel bad about it. But if I went too low and I was mediocre because I want to be in the top 50% of a race, I know I can do better than 50% in my age group. So why am I aiming for the top 50%? I want to be top 10% or I want to be whatever. So, and I tell people, so aim higher and higher. Lots of people come to us and say, I think I want to do a sprint triathlon this time next year. And then the year after, I might try an Olympic.
Mm.
I say, hang on a minute. If you've got time and the resources, money, family support, emotional support, etc., why are you aiming just for a relatively easy race?
Mm.
Let's go big.
Yeah,
I can be quite dangerous like that. And, and then people leave me having signed up for 6 marathons, you know, and I think, okay, I might have overdone this one.
Well, okay. Can you quickly tell us how you got into Optimal, you know, and what your role is there? Are you coaching?
Optimal Fitness is a wonderful small gym, and it's a holistic place where we do things probably not as well as you do, but we think we're excellent at our therapy, and we've got a real reputation growing. And it's lovely to be around people with a good reputation. And it's people.
Mm.
It's not about the business. It's about the people in the business.
Relationships.
We've got really good trainers who are happy to be there. We get no churn at all. Nobody seems to leave.
Mm.
In fact, we're now expanding and we're recruiting. And it seems quite easy to recruit because we've got a reputation for being a nice place to work. And that's really important to us.
Mm.
And our members coming into the gym, there's a gym part to it, are there because of the people, because of Melanie, the Filipino lady behind the desk.
Mm-hmm.
She's awesome. She knows their names. She knows what they're there for. She knows which classes they like.
Mm.
And she knows their children's names. All of the reception staff know that.
Mm.
And that's the sort of relationships we wanted to develop. So I loved it from the start. I'd been a member for 5 years when the partners said to me, David, we see you're out of a job because you're sitting in our cafe pretending to get one. and would you like to run Optimal?
Right.
And of course I said, yes. It means I can continue to do my sport and I'll be my own boss.
Okay.
So since then, we've grown a little bit and we're a profitable business now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're expanding. We're going to open a new Optimal Fitness down at the Meridian Airport Hotel.
Great.
Awesome.
And that opens over the summer. Mm-hmm. It's already there as a gym, but it needs a lot of work. And we will operate it for the Meridian. And the Meridian have basically supported us because of our reputation for producing excellence. Not perfection, but excellence.
That sounds fantastic.
And is it exclusively for triathlon competitors?
It's a leisure gym, as well as we have Luke Matthews. I mean, he's an awesome athlete. He's our head coach for triathlon. And we basically have a very sharp cap saying that we can't go any further than X amount of athletes because we want to be known for excellence, not piling it high and just giving people bad value. It's good value that we're looking for, and Luke delivers it in armfuls. He's a very, very good young man who's developing that side. But we also do leisure for mums who deliver off their children's school and then come to us afterwards to do group classes. Mm-hmm. Businessmen within the Studio City area who are who come to us at lunchtime and in the evenings. And we do a lot of personal training.
Okay.
And we've got a great cafe with good coffee, which is sort of the holistic piece because I drink a lot of coffee.
Right, okay. tell us about your typical day that you have, because you train a lot in a typical day, right? Like 2 to 3 times a day?
Well, when training for a big competition, I'll probably train a little more than that. I'll train between anything up to 24 to 30 hours a week. I don't take days off, although I know that you will tell me that I ought to have a rest day, etc. But I know my body. I know how much it can take and how much recovery it requires. So, yes, I train an awful lot. And normally when training for a big competition in the last 12 weeks or so, we're talking about 3 sessions a day.
Okay. And I know rest is a big part of what you promote, but what about food as well?
Well, sleep comes first.
Sleep first.
8 hours of sleep is what we try to prescribe for our athletes, and we want that before the exercise. And then nutrition is next. And I'm an advocate for everything in moderation, but I'm absolutely against sugar.
Okay.
In all its forms, including fruit. I think fruit is nature's candy. It should be eaten in balance with vegetables and a little bit of protein, meat, fish, etc. So everything in moderation, but not too many Snickers bars. You know, a bit of dark chocolate at the end of the evening or a glass of red wine, super. Whole bottle or, you know, a whole pack of chocolate, not so good.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's sleep first, then good nutrition, clean as we can get. If it's in a fridge, it's probably good. If it's in a packet, it's probably bad.
Simple.
Yeah.
Simple advice. You mentioned Luke Matthews. He's a vegan. What are your views on veganism?
No, he's plant-based.
That's a subject.
He wears leather shoes. You know, I mean, he's not doing it for any other reason than he thought he should try it because he'd heard about it, and he's going to try anything that he's going to recommend to his athletes. It is working for him very, very well. He's performing fantastically. He feels energetic. He has a very even power delivery all day, as it were. And yes, it sounds a bit extreme for some, but it works for him.
Yeah.
And everybody has their own tolerances. I'm big into dairy. I do dairy. But, you know, some people don't. Some people are less tolerant. Luke is doing a fantastic job on what would be seen by some to be an extreme diet. But actually, he's a very creative cook. He can create really yummy meals on the basis of nettles.
Okay. Do you cook much yourself, or does your wife do that?
No, I am absolutely appalling at cooking.
Yeah, me too.
if it's my turn to cook, I get the telephone.
Very good. One last point. You met the Queen a couple of times. You've been awarded the Order of the British Empire.
You have to understand that a lot of this is right time, right place. And with the OBE, it's known as the other beggar's effort.
Okay.
Okay? In other words, you were in charge of the team that delivered a result that got Her Majesty's attention.
Okay.
That doesn't mean you did it.
Okay.
Just because I am too egotistical to not wear it, I'm going to wear it because I was the boss at the time.
Yes.
But frankly, I was surrounded by the most wonderful people who delivered the most amazing results. And therefore, I got invited to the palace to go and receive the accolade for the whole team.
Very good. And the Duke of Edinburgh, you've also met him. He retired recently from...
He's a wonderful man. Absolutely. I just trust his advice. Now, I know he's said the wrong things many times, but he was the colonel of my regiment. So by chance, I had to host him a few times. He came to stay in the house. He sat at dinner because he was the colonel of my regiment. And it was, again, you know, time and place. So I got to know him a little bit. And he's one of those people that spend a whole lifetime talking only to people with a great amount of knowledge, to wisdom. And he's absorbed it. And he's bright enough to have made a choice in his opinion. So he, for instance, I probably shouldn't put words into his mouth, but I'm pretty sure he would say legalize drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Because he sees that the current system hasn't worked
yes.
in terms of dealing with recreational drugs and addiction.
Yes.
He would see it regulated, for instance. And this sort of, it's not politically correct.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't been in his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a product of his generation. He's, you know, 96 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still absolutely straight. He can stand up. He can squat. Mm-hmm. He can squat. And I'm planning to be that guy. When my children say, you're going to a home, Dad, I'm going to say, no, I'm going to continue to spend your inheritance because I can still get out of my chair.
That's it.
I'm going to keep getting out of my chair because that's the only reason people are sent to a care home is because they can't look after themselves because they can't get out of their chair. So if I leave one message with you all, squat, yeah. daily, squat, it'll keep you out of the adult nappy.
Well, that's as good advice as any to finish on.
The best advice I've heard so far. I should give it to all my patients too.
Well, listen, thank you so much for coming in today and talking to us. It's great to hear your opinions and your stories and what's happening. What are your plans for the immediate future? What's coming up? What's the next race?
Well, the next race is going to be South Africa next year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm determined to qualify for Kona. And as you see, I use language that I will qualify for Kona.
I like it, yep.
And then when I go to Kona, I will be on the... Now, this is all language, because if I persuade myself, the chances are my body will follow.
Sure.
I hope. So that's the next race. But for the rest of this year, I'm trying to be a businessman and develop this new gym and make sure that I give my partners value for their trust and in the case of Meridian, their investment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about a matter of delivering excellence in a new venue, and I'm going to copy an awful lot of what DIS.
We hope
has.
You can.
This is awesome here. Yeah. What a place! And everybody out there, if you want to get fixed, if you can't come to Optimal Fitness, come to DISC because this is absolutely incredible. This is a great place and it's great people.
Well, that's very kind of you.
It's a pleasure having you, David. And I also like to add that we all work together to make the community better. You know, and it's never a competition for us. It's always supporting businesses that do the same thing we do because at the end of the day, we're therapists and there's plenty for everyone. And, you know, we wish you the absolute best and we push all our patients also to go get fit, try riding with David. He will disappear very quickly. I remember doing that once, maybe 5 years ago when I first moved out here and within 5 minutes he was gone. And that was the day I was like, I can either make it or never or never do this again. But it was very, very inspiring. So I think surround yourselves with those who inspire you. And, you know, one of my friends always told me run with the lions because that's the way you only get faster and better in life. So thank you again for being here today. And we really enjoyed having you.
Tomorrow.
And the best of luck.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
Bye.